freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a friend.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
Ah, we stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
Well, here we go with another Brock and Salk podcast. Another quarantine edition. Hi, Brock, from your home.
Hello, Michael.
Good to be with you again. Howdy, still under his blankets. Kyle, I did get to communicate with Howdy a little bit this week on video, so I saw the blanket you've been talking about. I didn't get to see the pot of food, which he claims now was popcorn.
That's just a timing issue.
He claims it was popcorn, but I did get to see him under the blanket, shivering.
He says his house is freezing, so and he doesn't have privileges to touch the thermostat.
No, it's very sad. It's very sad, which is why I think he's...
In true Howdy's fashion, he's found a workaround.
Yes.
He's used all parts at his disposal, and he's made it work.
Yes. So,
credit to Howdy.
He will not be on the podcast once again, although I will say, more of a feature than a bug with this whole... we're operating out of different homes and stuff. Howdy not being on the podcast, more of a feature than a bug. Brock, one interesting thing over the weekend was watching all of the networks showing all of these classic games, right?
So have you gotten in? I feel like you've gotten into that a little bit. Certainly Wassel, Graz, the Graz father is big time into that. It's weird. I have not.
Really?
Yeah, for some reason I have not gotten into that. I don't know why. It's not like I'm anti it. And I'm sure, and that's not totally true. Like, I've watched with the passing of Coach Lambright this week, and, you know, I've watched some of the old Husky clips and, mm-hmm. and, you know, some of the different video tributes and things of that nature. But no, I don't think I haven't. I have not hunkered yet down on my couch and watched an entire game.
Well, let me be clear. I've only watched like one entire game. So I don't want to make it feel like I'm doing more than I actually have been. I watched the entire Roger Clemens first 20 strikeout game. That was 2 hours. They condensed it into 2 hours. I watched all of that on ESPN on Saturday morning.
Who was that versus?
That was against Mariners. Yeah, 1986.
That's right.
We'll come back to that one in a minute. I watched some of Duke, Kentucky in 98 when I was in college. Okay. I watched some of John Starks and Michael Jordan battling. That was kind of fun. I watched some Mariners in 2001. I watched Dodgers A's from 88, the Gibson home run game. It's been a sampling. I haven't gone crazy with it, but I mean, almost every station has it. I mean, you kind of flip through between
sure.
Root Has It Night, MLB Network is showing classic games, ESPN, CBS, you know, NBC, or the NBC Sports Network, right? The NBA channel, NHL channel. It is pretty cool because they're all playing their A material.
Yep.
It's not just like, you know, random. They're games that you haven't gotten to see a ton of. And when you get a chance, you're like, oh, man, this is actually kind of awesome. So here's my overall takeaway. Let me go through some of the specifics. But my overall takeaway in watching a bunch of these old games, the NFL is better today than it was then.
Is this a takeaways or tidbits?
No, it's a big picture.
Kyle, do we have takeaways music?
We don't. We're not going takeaways music, I promise. But the NFL is better than it used to be.
Yes.
I think I could argue that golf is better than it used to be. And every other sport is worse.
Oh, really?
The NFL is better than it once was. I would argue golf is, and sort of, you know, post-Tiger, like the Tiger Revolution and HD has really changed golf as well. And every other sport looks worse than it did then. Baseball,
wow.
Hockey, basketball, call it, they all look worse than they did back in the day. And, you know, look, it's entirely possible this is just me being an old man, but I think I can come up with reasons why I think all of these things. You kind of start with the NFL. The NFL's better now. It is faster. It's sharper. There's more action. The quarterbacks are better. We'll talk to Phil Sims about that coming up here in a little bit. The uniforms look better, right? They're crisp. They look so modern and almost super modern, almost futuristic. I think the NFL, the camera angles that they have, the NFL looks great right now.
The pace of play
right.
is fast. The slow-mo is incredible. The level of, as you mentioned, you know, these elite games and even the average games still have so much technology. The broadcasters, Mike, have never been better.
Never.
I mean, they're right. absolutely at their very best when it comes to football. So, yeah, I'm probably with you that while the game was very violent and quarterbacks could be hit and driven into the ground and given the DDT and the pile driver in the 80s and even into the 90s.
And that part was great. Don't get me wrong. I miss that. I think the NFL game would be better if it had all of those things in addition to what it does have. Yeah. I think you could make an argument.
So even though the violence has come down, the violence and the hits over the middle and, yes, the, you know, and the Ronnie Lott's, you know, knocking dudes out and being able to truly, you know, go for, and Pete Carroll, remember him sitting with us talking about Chuck Cecil and how,
right,
back
okay,
in the day.
Maybe we don't need that anymore, but in no, between, I mean, the NFL maybe was at its best 5, 6, 7 years ago. Is that fair? I mean, like, they've taken a little too much of that out and you're missing some of those big hits and that part's a bummer. But
yeah,
God, the overall look and feel of the NFL, just,
I would agree with
it's
you,
so great. Yeah. It's so fast paced. It just looks right. And then you,
I would agree with that.
You watch,
I'll give you that one.
You watch baseball from back in the day. So I watched, yeah, you know, I watched some from 86, from 01, from 88. Baseball is better then. And I, you know, I love baseball. Like, it's never going to, it's always going to mean the world to me, but it was faster paced. The pitchers didn't step off between every pitch. The batter stayed in the box and didn't take a walk around to make sure that all the cameras were on them. They bunt, they steal, they run, they strategize, all the things that have been taken out of the game, yeah, by sabermetrics. And I understand why. I'm not arguing that they should be back in the game because they work, but I am arguing that taking them out of the game removes a whole element that was fun to watch.
Yeah,
the crowds
the
are into it,
Mike. The strategery back
we're
in the
missing
day,
all the strategery.
Yes,
the crowds
and the
are
uniforms,
into it.
And don't you think the uniforms to some degree were almost better?
What do you mean almost? The uniforms were better. I watched that 86 Roger Clemens game, Brock.
Yeah.
Every person on the field was wearing stirrups.
Yep,
it looked great. Yeah. It looked awesome. The Mariners had sweet uniforms with no buttons, right? They looked awesome. The Red, yep, Sox are wearing their classic 86 whites. I mean, like, it looked great. The crowds are into it. Nobody has to wait for the Jumbotron to tell them the rules or
you weren't
to
missing
tell them when
the,
to cheer.
You weren't missing the K-Zone, you know, the little,
nope,
box.
Didn't miss
you
it at all.
You weren't missing that.
I missed the velocity.
Yeah.
I missed the pitching, you know, the gun.
Yes.
But other than that, no, I didn't miss any of the other things they've added to the broadcast.
I wonder if that is, maybe we should put out a little Twitter poll, you know, maybe a daily little Twitter poll you can have over the next 4 or 5 days coming off of this conversation and see if people tend to agree or disagree. Because, yeah, I've heard that. I've heard that from Graz. I've heard that from Wassel. I've heard that from those on over at our station that are spending quite a bit of time going back and watching and reminiscing with many of these games. And it's just the action. It's the activity. Mm-hmm. There is so much more going on. The managers and the thinking and, you know, and the base stealing and just all of it. Small ball, the big ball, it had every facet of it.
But I don't want to just complain about it. You know, that's the problem, is we get into this complaining mode and I don't have a solution. I feel bad. Like, you can't remove sabermetrics from the game. The problem we have is that while all of those things were really fun to watch, they're not as good for strategy and winning as what they've developed now.
And you know what's amazing about watching some of those old baseball games is, you know what a hit is.
Right. Yeah. Like when the ball gets the bat, you're like, oh, that's,
yes,
a hit.
When the ball gets hit certain spots, you're like, that's a hit.
Yep.
And in today's game, you don't know where they're shifted. Like,
that's,
oh,
true.
I wonder if there's
anybody over there.
That's not a hit.
It's true.
Yeah, the second baseman's right behind second base now in this shift, and of course he's lined up perfectly to take that away. And yep, there you go. That one's hit right into the shift.
I'll tell you too. You. I watched the that 20 strikeout game. First three pitches of the game, Roger Clemens at home, Spike Owen up for the Mariners leading off, who later became a Red. They had the big trade that year with Henderson and Spike, uh-huh, Owen going over to the Red Sox. Roger throws the first three pitches at his head. I mean, not directly at his head, but all three are high and inside. One of them fully brushes him off the plate and knocks him down. First three pitches of the game. He goes on to strike him out and then record 19 more over the next 9 innings.
You think that was intentional?
I don't think it's an accident. Right? Yes. And Ned Martin's on the call points out that they were teammates in college, but it didn't matter. Roger, yeah, comes right out. He's big. He's still got the baby fat on him in 1986. Yeah. It was before he developed the split finger, so he's throwing more of like a curve slider type deal in addition to the high fa-. There's another one. He's throwing high fastball after high fastball, and guys are swinging and missing at him. I mean, it's night and day compared to what we watched today, and I do love baseball. I love the game now. But it was better then. And, you know, I saw last night game 5 of the 04 ALCS was on, Red Sox-Yankees. I was at that game. It couldn't have been more than 25 degrees out. It was so cold. I had the flu. I was like a cold. It was miserable. It was the best game I've ever been to in any sport. I mean, it was an incredible, incredible game. But I was thinking about how much baseball meant to me then, and just that Red Sox team was, you know, the team I was following at the time. In addition to some of the desperation in Boston to break that curse, every series it felt like that team might fight with somebody or something crazy would happen. And I don't think they were alone like that. I mean, you know, they almost got into
there was an intensity, right?
There was.
It just feels, and this isn't ripping on it. It is just different. It is science now. It is data now. It's a little bit more sterilized in that way. It's in some ways like watching a game from a press box, right? Versus being in the stands. Like there just isn't that animosity. There doesn't feel to be that rivalry. There's not that vitriol. There's not just some of that intensity that you could feel watching those games still spill out.
Why?
You know, I'd hate to say that the money is part of that the money is so big now, because guys back then made huge money for their eras.
Especially, you know, we're talking about 2000, 2004. I mean, that was post A-Rod contract in Texas.
Sure.
So it's not like guys weren't getting big money then. So it's not. It can't just be the money. I have some ideas. I think, and this you know, the same argument's going to go to the NBA and to a lesser extent the NHL. You know, I think some of it is the way the guys get to know each other off the field or off the court in other settings that bring them together.
Yeah.
Right? They know each other through their agents, through their hitting coaches, through their Nike sneaker deals or whatever. I think they all know
each
other.
Through training together in the off seasons and I think that, and just, you know, kind of the social fabric, how much easier it is to be connected. Can you imagine players back in the day giving each other their jerseys?
No, not publicly. Now, here's the thing, though. I will say, for years, guys have always had relationships with players and opponents who they fought with or whatever. I mean, we've heard stories. Scott Servais has told the stories of fighting with guys that he had known. I think Pete Harnish is on that list. We know that, you know, I've always heard the story that Jim Thome and Riel Cormier got into a brawl. It's actually a great one. I think Cormier throws his glove at Thome. It's like, yeah, good luck. And sort of ducks out of the way of one of the biggest humans I've ever seen. The story is that they gave each other a ride home that night, that they were already planning to drive because they were hunting buddies, and they drove home together. So I think that's always been the case. I think that for whatever reason, in that era, players were willing to put that aside once they got, I don't know. It's really hard for me to determine. I don't know what the root of it is.
How about, you know, and I've heard this from a number of players today and just over the last couple years, of just how hard the game is today.
Mm-hmm.
Just how much failure there is. And there was always failure. It wasn't as if guys hit 380, you know, 20 years ago, but, you know, there were a bunch more guys hitting above 300.
Sure.
And, you know, there weren't how many guys throwing 95 that they saw. Like Roger Clemens back then was an absolute phenom with his velocity. Well, yeah, now you're seeing it from three of the five starters in the rotation and five of the seven guys in the bullpen. And it's just, it's hard. It's debilitatingly hard, you know, to hit to some of that degree. And, you know, the fielding, how good of a fielder do you have to be with all of these shifts? And we're able to just shift everybody and minimize some of that. You know, I don't know. I wonder if some of the strategy and the difficulty of the game as well has played somewhat of a role in some of
it's
that.
It's a good point. I mean, and in some ways the same has been true the opposite has been true in the NFL, where in some ways they've made the game a little bit easier. I know that some of the terminology and the complexity of it is harder, but by taking away some of the hitting and they've opened the game up and made it easier. Well,
look at
the
completion
the right
percentage
argument,
of quarterbacks.
A little bit easier.
Phil Simms is going to join us here in our next segment. Jim Zorn was, I believe, a guy who ended his career with more interceptions than touchdowns. Back in the day, if Terry Bradshaw completed 50% of his passes, he's having a good day. QBs today, you don't complete 65% and throw twice as many touchdowns as picks. Mm-hmm. You're not playing. Like, it's actually been a whole lot easier statistically to get catches and to get completions and to get yards and to have an incredible touchdown interception rate. And, you know, those things in football, especially at that most important positions, right? That trend has gone the opposite of baseball, where it has gotten harder and harder and harder to produce.
Maybe that is actually a good lens with which to look through golf. I mean, I think golf looks better now. HD has helped golf a lot. You watch some of the old classic golf on TV without HD, it does not look the same. You know what I mean? I mean, HD has really done a wonder for that.
Yes.
But in some ways, the game is easier than it was then.
Correct.
The guys are hitting it longer. right?
Yes. Technology,
listen to Brandel Chambly, he'll tell you that they've cut down the rough and they've made the rough a lot easier to get out of on most of the. And so I wonder whether that has helped the game because the players can act with a little bit more confidence, even though there's so much pressure on them. And that's another game that's all about, you know, handling the pressure. But I wonder if that has helped that game quite a bit.
Yeah, technology has improved. You know, clubs are much more forgiving than the woods that those guys had to hit back in the day. The technology in that sport has absolutely enhanced the broadcasts, from the swing speed to the exit velocity to the shot arc and the shots and following the ball.
Time they show that. I mean, I will actively get annoyed when they show an approach shot that doesn't have the tracker. Well, how am I supposed to know where that thing goes? Is it a draw? What's he doing? Yes. Like, come on. What's the arc? What's the height? What's the apex? Yeah. Like, I want that. I don't care if you ever
show. What club is he hitting?
Take the K zone. I want
to know what club he's hitting.
Take the K zone and throw it away. I don't ever need it. But I absolutely need the technology to make the golf broadcast interesting. So, yeah, I think making that game a little bit easier over the years has helped. And then the NBA, I don't know. I this one's hard for me because I've just sort of lost interest in it. But, you know, watching Jordan versus Starks and seeing the physicality, seeing the passing, seeing the rivalry and the hatred, fewer threes, right? More of a team game. I don't know. I think the NBA game was a lot better then.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably have the most bias in this one.
I do.
Of all of them. You have the most love for the game, I think, of baseball. So maybe there's the most passion with that. But as far as bias goes, yeah, you're probably the most biased in this one.
I loved the NBA as a kid. And you know, I guess I've watched some of that Magic versus Bird documentary has been on again. So I was watching some of that. And the hatred in their eyes, those two teams for each other.
Yeah.
I mean, I know you get some of these feuds in modern day basketball, but they feel contrived to me. I know there are people out there who are yelling at me right now. No, they're not contrived. These guys really hate each other. Maybe they feel like these sort of fabricated social media WWE style feuds. Whereas I think Kurt Rambis and Kevin McHale would have actively fought each other to the death if you had given them the opportunity to do so.
Well, it's hard to imagine that in this era or even over the last 10 years that you could put together what's going to be coming out. And it looks like ESPN has moved up the date. Did you see this?
Yeah,
to April 19th of the 10-part, 20-hour series on the Bulls. It's hard to imagine that any of LeBron's teams or any of the Golden State Warrior teams or any of that stuff would have anywhere near, like in 20 or 30 years, oh man, I can't wait to watch this story.
But is some of that because it's already out there with social media, with 24-hour reporting, et cetera? I mean, there are going to be stories about the Bulls the way they were about the Celtics and Lakers, et cetera, that we didn't hear because who was going to tell them to us? I mean, now the players just constantly, you know, they take a video camera into their locker room and now you know what it's like.
Yeah, they're their own marketing machines.
Yes.
It's almost over-marketing. Today's NBA almost feels like it's over. You would think that there's no way to over-market. The NFL has shown there's no way to over-market, that you know, you want to just grow that appetite every single day. But for some reason, that NBA deal just feels saturated. It just feels, you said the word contrived. Right. It just feels and maybe it was that way 30 years ago where those players felt the same way. Like, I don't want to play 82 games. I don't need to play 82 games. But I don't know. When I watched the Sonics in the 80s and the 90s, those guys, I never heard of load management. I never heard of them not wanting to play, of looking for ways to back out. I know GP didn't love practice, neither did Allen Iverson, but those dudes played 82 games and it mattered to them.
Yeah. So. And it's important to say, I understand why they do the load management. I totally, if I were an NBA coach, I wouldn't let my superstar play more than about 10, 12 games a year. Yep. Go sit down. We'll see you in the playoffs. Let's get to whatever we need to do to get there and we'll see you then. But it hurts the product. And so I don't know. I've loved all the conversations you and I have had since moving over to this podcast format. This is the first time where I have found myself missing the ability to interact with the text toy on this. Because I think a lot of the responses from you guys would be interesting as people saying, you know, you guys are old, you guys are just, you know, relishing back in the day and you're just being grandpas, okay, boomer. But I don't know. I mean, I do think the NFL game is better now. I do love the old NFL, too. I mean, there's some things I miss, but I think the NFL game is great. I think that it, I don't think we're being old men. Maybe we are, and especially on basketball, I'm sure there's a whole gang of people, yeah, you know, a ton of our listeners who would be saying, you guys are nuts. Curtis is in the other room right now. If Curtis was here, he'd probably be on that list, just saying,
yeah,
you guys
are
crazy.
Are you kidding me? Look at the guys shooting. You're just bragging about the QB percentage,
right,
and touchdowns and completions. Look at these guys' abilities to shoot. Damian Lillard is shooting nearly half-court shots, and
right,
look at their ability to, in the range that they have, and the shooting percentages they have, and the athleticism of today's game.
But it's not varied the same way. And I guess that's the difference. You know, Phil Simms is going to come on with us. He'll talk, you know, we recorded this earlier, so I can tell you. He'll talk a little bit about how back in the day, every offense was the same. They all ran the same 12 plays. Now they're completely different. And some of that variety is important. That's what baseball has lost a little bit, right? Some mm-hmm. of the variety. One team is built to hit home runs. Another team is built to run around and hit singles and bunt and this and that. One's a pitching team. They've lost some of that variety. And I guess that's the sense I get out of the NBA, is that the game itself has lost variety, and people always, you know, oh, the lost art of the mid-range jumper. It's not just that. It's just choosing. Are they going to shoot a three or are you going to dunk? Those are your choices.
Yeah.
And most of it comes off an ISO play. And so, I don't know. I guess
and a lot of that
I'm
comes
saying.
Off today's analytics, Mike, kind of the baseball too, where, hey, this is what the numbers tell you to do.
Yeah. So maybe
this
it's on me. Maybe
strategy.
We should be adapting, Brock. Maybe this is on us and we should be finding more ways to enjoy that instead of lamenting the good old days. But seeing all these old games has definitely brought it up for me.
Yeah. And I know, you know, we want to get to Phil here in a little bit, but I'd be remiss to not talk about the old days just a little bit with the passing of Jim Lambright, my former coach in college. And it plays a little bit into this conversation of old school versus new school. And I could show you the number of different texts of former teammates as we've kind of gotten together here this week as the news came out that Coach, and I think many of us knew that he was battling dementia. And I had seen him, I think you and maybe Mike had even been there at one of the Hall of Fame luncheons over at CenturyLink Field. And that was the first time I saw him a couple years ago and went, wow, yeah, this is changing. There's, you know, serious deterioration, and you could always see the intensity in his eyes. Speaking of that baseball intensity, man, he just had a fierceness to him, and that was the first time a couple years ago that you could start to see that certainly slipping away. But man, he was old school, and he was tough. And there were a lot of guys, a lot of my teammates this week, kind of going through the circumstances we are in life, saying, man, I'm thankful for that experience. It wasn't really fun going through it, and all the two-a-days and all the hitting. And in particular, before the indoor facility was built, I remember that grass field that that's over there by the stadium. It's now the indoor facility. But back in the day, that was just a grass field. And we would all get rashes on our legs. And nobody would really say anything like, man, what is this rash from? Why am I getting all this rash? Well, it was the geese poop. You know, I mean, it's just you're practicing in crap. And, you know, you didn't ask really questions or think too much about it. Like, everyone was in it together. And, okay, all right, we're all going to get a little bit of a rash from the geese poop, but doesn't really matter. Like, we're going to practice. And practicing outside in windstorms, we had a practice in Husky Stadium, I remember, one year. I mean, it was a pineapple express of expresses, and I'm throwing fade routes to start practice, and the ball's coming back at me. Like, this is worthless. This is meaningless. I'm going to hurt my arm. Ball's going to be so waterlogged. What are we even doing out here? But it made you better, you know, and in that game, when you play in those conditions, it made you better. And when, you know, you lined up and those teams that I was fortunate to play on that were so physical, and Damon did, and those teams in the 80s that, you know, in the 90s that were able to impose their will physically, that doesn't happen just by saying we're going to be that kind of team. It happens just with the incredible, you know, work and practice and toughness. And I'll leave you with this. And it's probably the ultimate reason. I don't know if I've even shared this story explicitly, but when it came down to me looking at Washington and UCLA, and those were the two schools for me, and I love Terry Donahue and I love Sunshine. I still do. And I had a great recruiting trip there until I met the strength coach at UCLA at that time. And I went in there and looked at their weight room, and it was like in the downstairs, kind of a basement of a gym. And there just wasn't much going on. There weren't many players in there. You know, I was just not impressed at all. And that was a 180 stark contrast from the amount of physical pain and torture and work that I knew Damon put in and Billy Joe put in and Tom Gallagher put in and all the Puyallup guys that went to Washington put in, and I could see it, you know, and Steve Entman and those guys, it just lifted and lifted and worked and worked. And that weight room was the mecca, man. That was the center of building that toughness. And you're going to squat till you drop, and you're going to clean, and you're going to lift. And, you know, it's going to be the essence of what you were. And if there was a, like the most distinct difference between those two programs, it was there. It was that weight room. It was the conditioning tests. It was everything that Don James built. That Lambright was right there lockstep with him, and a huge, huge part of our program.
How long had he been there before you arrived?
Forever.
As the head coach.
As the head coach? Oh, that's, I think, just a couple years.
Okay.
Yeah. I think just two or three years. And you know what? He was a head coach that had to go through probation. And we had two recruiting classes that absolutely played a role in the program taking a step back from where it was to where it got to. And ultimately, unfortunately, for Jim to, and that staff to not be able to weather it and survive it. But yeah, he will have a record that I will say, will never be broken. I cannot imagine another person at a university having the run that he had for four decades. And I think it's some 368 games. I should have that number in front of me, where he was either a player, an assistant coach, or a head coach. I mean, I just cannot, in today's day and age of job security and sticking around one place and being there for as a player, an assistant, and as a head coach, I can't imagine anybody ever touching his record that I think will last forever as far as a longtime Husky in that capacity. Come on, give me Phil. Come on.
Yes, Phil. I'm here.
Oh, Phil's here. Whew.
Yes.
You hear me?
We got you.
Yeah. Oh, it's all so right. Great to hear that voice right there.
I don't hear that too often, I'll tell you, especially in my household.
We'll jump right into it.
Oh, my God, he's home?
Everybody's home. What do you mean he's home?
Yeah, well,
we're all home.
When I used to do games, well, every once in a while I'd get a Giant game or a Jet game, so I got to stay home on Friday and Saturday night, and I would say to my wife something or whatever, and my wife would look at my daughter and go, "We like it when Daddy travels on weekends." Okay, thank you. Good to be here.
Well, we like having you on with us.
Separation.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us for the first time on the Brock and Salk podcast.
Yeah, great to be on. Great to be on.
We have all the time in the world, so we can explore things with you. And we always felt when we
do whatever you want, let's rock.
When we had you on the show, we'd always feel like, we didn't quite have enough time. We could have gone another 10, 20 minutes or whatever it might be. So we can really explore the studio space with Phil Simms.
All right, good.
All right, we'll start with the current day.
And I need to warm up my mouth. Let's go.
You don't
I haven't talked in a while.
Let's start with the current day, then we'll start here in Seattle, kind of talk about these Seahawks, who have not done a tremendous amount in the offseason so far. They've been waiting, I guess, and certainly waiting defensively, despite having a defense that wasn't very good last year. What do you think they're going to do? Are they going to fix this pass rush, Phil?
Well, that's a good question. Well, you know, I guess we start with Jadeveon Clowney. What's going to happen there? You know, it's going to be interesting. And, you know, I think he's going to sit there and find out there's probably not going to be a lot of great suitors for him. So just because of the question marks about his injury, it'll be interesting where he ends up. But if he ends up back in Seattle, that's a great start for him for sure.
Well, why are there questions about him? I mean, it's funny. When we're here, we tend to think of him. We thought he was going to be getting the $20 million or so, maybe even $18 million that he wanted. And yet it sounds like the rest of the league isn't valuing him that way. From the national perspective, where's the disconnect there?
Well, I think that isn't the disconnect the fact that he wants more than a one-year contract? And, you know, that's a couple things I've heard. But, listen, if I was a team and had Super Bowl aspirations and all that stuff, which we know Seattle always does, and, you know, you got to take chances. Sometimes you got to gamble to get greatness. And I think he's such an unbelievable player. I wish we could see him healthy and see what he can. My son has a great word for him. I don't want to say what he says. He messes up more plays than just about any defensive player in the NFL. And you look at the stat line, the game is over, and he has, you know, no sacks, one quarterback hit, and a few tackles. but he creates so much havoc that it's, you know, stats lie all the time in football, and they definitely lie when you talk about Jadeveon Clowney.
But he is a guy, Phil, that's had microfracture surgery on his knee.
Yep.
There were a lot of questions coming even out of college. So once you have
once
you have that surgery, that is a major, major red flag. He now has a sports hernia surgery, probably not as big a deal as that knee. But he's a guy that's been nicked up throughout his career. So he wants long-term security. He wants a long-term deal. The league is telling him, the market is telling him, hey, I'm sorry, you can get a short-term deal and maybe even a one-year deal if you were the Seahawks,
right,
knowing that that is what the market has said to him, and he's playing a little game of chicken right now. What would be a deal you would be comfortable putting together? Short-term, long-term, mid-year, what would you think be the most home-run deal for the Seahawks?
Oh, I think it's got to be a one-year deal. I don't think anybody's going to stick it out there. Well, maybe somebody will take a chance and give him the first year. They will pay him and then guarantee a little bit of the second year or whatever. But, you know, unfortunately for Clowney, I think he's been in the league long enough and whatever. I don't know if he'll ever get a long-term deal. Even if he signs a one-year deal and has a great year, that knee is still there. Microfracture surgery, you guys know that used to be the death. Your career was over just about in every sport. So the fact that he has hung on and done what he's done since he had it, it's worked out. But to answer your question, I think it's going to be a one-year deal for no matter who signs him. It's just a question of how much money.
Hey, and you're talking to two guys, and Salk referenced this earlier, Phil, that watched every one of these Seahawks games, and they were not good on defense. They had, I think, as a team, 28.5 sacks. You know, and stats can lie, but that one was pretty accurate when you watched them. You know, they had a really hard time affecting especially quality quarterbacks. They had a hard time, you know, stopping the run for back-to-back years. And he was, to our eye, watching it week in and week out, their best, most disruptive player. So if they don't sign him back and they don't get this one-year deal done or guarantee it a little bit into a second year, who in this draft or what is left in this market that you think is going to improve this defense?
Well, you know, doing the draft, I've done quite a bit. I'm trying to catch up. My computer, believe it or not, I don't know why, the system I get on, they switched it. So Monday, I get my computer back, but I'm been piecing together, doing quarterbacks, defensive backs, a little bit, wide receivers. But the draft, it's not loaded with edge rushers, that's for sure. And, you know, the Seahawks, you know, I got to be honest, I was a little disappointed last year. You know, Jaron Reed, everything. I just thought they were going to have a great pass rush, and it just never really came together. So to Jadeveon Clowney, I think when it all settles down, or what's the old saying, when the dust settles, I think he'll end up with Seattle because he knows the place. I'm sure he feels a little bit comfortable there. He knows the defense, and I just don't see another team taking all that money and putting it on him and taking the chance that he could be gone quick as the season starts, and all of a sudden here they are, you know, they're in trouble. So I hope it works out for him. I thought, but you're right. Just watching them play, I forgot what game it was. What was the Monday night game?
Was it the 49ers? Yeah, 49er game down in San Francisco.
I mean,
yeah.
Oh my God, that was, he was like off the planet how well he played that night. It was tremendous. And, of course, the 49ers defense speaks for itself. But when I saw that game, that's the guy that I used to see down in Houston and in spurts. But, of course, injuries have always kind of – it's ruined his career as far as the way we look at him. But when he's healthy and he's raring to go, he's one of the best disruptors in the NFL, probably the best disruptor in the NFL, right up there with Aaron Donald.
Are there other guys, you mentioned a player who can disrupt and screw up an entire game without putting anything really onto the score sheet? Are there other guys like that? I'm having trouble
thinking. Well, yeah, Aaron Donald's one. He does. You know, he gets double-teamed all the time, so that helps people. And he still busts through, makes quarterbacks move, and we're, you know, people just – you know, wipe up and get the sacks. And, you know, you look at, oh, Aaron Donald's really struggled the last 3 weeks. He has only so many tackles and no sacks. Well, watch the games, then tell me how he's doing. So there's not many like that. J.J. Watt, of course, was tremendous before the injury bug hit him. He could just completely mess up plays. And wow, when he was doing it and they had Jadeveon Clowney there, that was some pair. But boy, it's like we saw it for five games in their careers, and that's about it, because both fighting the injuries. So, but it's, yeah, disruptors, you know, they're just great things to look for. You know, you look for those kind of players, and there's not many of them out there, and there's not many Jadeveon Clowneys out there for sure.
I mean, Jim Burt was one of those guys, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a disruptor, but not on the field, off the field, causing trouble for everybody. That was a different thing. So, but, yeah. But Jim, the one thing about Jim Burt, linebackers loved him because he could hold up a Mack truck. I mean, man, when they say two gap, he could stand there and you couldn't move him with a truck. So Harry Carson and Gary Reasons and Pepper Johnson, they didn't get hit too often. They were running free because of guys like Jim Burt. So that's a whole other thing depending on your defense.
I wasn't old.
When you have great linebackers, do you have what Earl Leggett? Do you remember Earl Leggett, Brock? Mike, you remember him?
Ooh, I don't remember Earl Leggett.
Line coach. Played in the NFL, defensive line coach, and he says, if you want a great defense, Sims, he came as Dan Reeves, had him 1 year. He goes, you need two big old tush hogs inside. And I go, what the hell's a tush hog, girl? He's so country. He goes, you know, those guys, when they bend over and get on in their stance, you can show a double feature on their rear end. And when you got those two guys, man, your defense, you can cook it. And I just laughed. And it's so funny. To this day, I always kind of look at certain defenses, especially, of course, 4-3s that play a certain way, where you can free up linebackers and defensive ends because you have two guys inside that can just control the middle of the field. So, but Seattle doesn't quite play that style, so it doesn't fit. But those kind of guys don't quite fit the system they're playing.
I'll tell you, you mentioned Jim Burt. All I'll ever think of is him with his – was it his son or his daughter, his kid – at the Super Bowl, he brought his kid down off the out of the stands.
Yeah.
His whole, that image, I mean, I couldn't have been more than 10 years old. That image, 11 years old, something like that, that will stay with me for the rest of my life. I don't know why, but as soon as you mention his name, Brock, obviously I think about him decking Joe Montana, but I also think of him with his kid. And it just seemed like that Giants team was one of the first, at least to me, again, I was a kid, that felt like it bonded with the fans, but also had kind of a family atmosphere to it. Was that the case?
Well, yeah, it was. We had a lot of guys that were very close, and you know, Brock, you know, being an ex-player, you know, when you're playing well and you're on a good team, the chemistry is good. You know, it's amazing how that works. Good chemistry when you win, and you know, everybody buys in because you want to be part of it. And you know, especially there for a few years, we really had it rolling, and so we were close, and we were used to going to work and really practicing hard and really being, what's the word for it, critiqued and taking criticism because we got a lot of it. You know, a lot like what Bill Belichick does. I really believe Belichick learned a lot of his things and ways from Bill Parcells. You know, every day was the most important day of our life, and here's what we're going to do. And, you know, that meeting, that real quick meeting you had every morning, I mean, I thought, hell, are we playing the Super Bowl today? What is going on? And the pressure, truly, I kid you not, when you walked in the locker room, the meetings and everything, you felt the pressure of practice. It's coming. Man, I got to have a great practice today. I got to have it, you know. And it was there. I'd go out in the practice field almost every day, nervous, going, all right, man, I got to be on. I got to hit it. Let's go. And it's the way we practice. That's why sometimes the old thing, it is true. Couldn't wait for the games just so I'd get away from the coaches. So
I was looking for a little segue. We will get to Russell and the draft and some of these quarterbacks and everything else and today's NFL, kind of bigger stories. But I was looking for a kind of a segue, obviously, into what we all are going through right now, which is not normal, which is difficult, which are, you know, some circumstances and adversity unlike we have seen and for many of us in our lives have never really seen before. How much do you look back, Phil, on some of those experiences, on some of those hardships, on some of those adversities and challenges, and waking up day after day after day in some of that environment? How much of that experience you think plays a role for you and maybe some of your past teammates and guys that kind of lived in that culture of dealing with the circumstances of today?
Well, I think, you know, guys, I really, you know, you always hear this thing, you know, football is a great teacher of life and all that. You know, when I was young, I'm like, oh, come on, just let me play. But as time went on, and in the sport, and of course, once my career was over, and you really start thinking about things, you realize it is, and so you learn to deal with everything, and you can deal with it. You can deal with adversity, because what is NFL football? It's nothing but adversity. Man, you're like winning, but you know, it's still, it just, if it can go wrong, it goes wrong in the NFL. And I really think it does, you know. So this staying in my house, really nobody comes in except maybe my family. Even when my kids do stop over, we're very careful. And I'm looking at my hands right now, they're cracking from keeping them, washing them constantly and all that stuff. So I don't know. The discipline you learn, I think, from playing sports, especially football, because it's such a team game and it's discipline and all that, is such a huge deal in winning and performing well that you're able to deal with these other things in life. And I think this is one of them. So I have not found it hard myself. Yes, I'd love to go outside and throw with some of the young quarterbacks we throw with and all these other things, but hey, this is what we got, and I can hang in there, I think, as long as I have to.
What are you doing all day?
Well, I really am just studying all the players, to be honest. I'm sitting in my office right now, and I can't wait. Like I told you, can't wait for my computer, but I've studied some of the quarterbacks. Unfortunately, I don't have film on all of them. The ones I really like to try to do, anywhere from 15 to 20 quarterbacks that are coming out in the draft, just to see, to watch. And then I'm always looking for one or two every year that is, I say, man, I would take that guy in the sixth or seventh round. He might not ever play one down, but he also has a chance to at least to be a backup. And maybe the talent is good enough if he gets a chance and it falls right, because you got to be lucky now. If you're not a first-round draft pick or whatever, you got to be lucky to get a shot at playing quarterback in the NFL. You need breaks to fall your way. So I can't wait to do that. So far, all I've gotten in is let's see, I'm trying to think. Herbert, of course, Joe Burrow, Tua, and Jordan Love I've watched just because I dug up some YouTube tapes and got to watch him play three games. So it's kind of hard to judge him. But and I saw Jake Fromm too. I only had four come up on my computer, where usually I get 40 or 50, which I will have come Monday. So,
well, I will be curious, maybe after you watch Jacob Eason out here in our neck of the woods, maybe we can text each other and catch up a little bit, because there's quite a mixed opinion.
That, you know, and I'm really anxious to watch him. I saw him on TV a few times. Of course, to say he caught my eye is an understatement. I said, whoa. He caught my eye when he was at Georgia. You know, I know the arm. I watched him at the combine. Is he 6'6"? Is that his official height?
Yeah, he's just a hair under 6'6". But, yeah, he's right about there.
A hair under 6'6".
Yeah.
But I know he has a good arm. When I saw him play a few times on TV, you know, sometimes it's hard to catch the Pac-10 or Pac-12, whatever the hell it's called.
Pac-8.
I don't know.
Yeah, Pac-8 out here.
Pac-8. Is that what it is?
No.
Pac-8?
Not yet. Not anymore.
You know what's interesting, Phil, is I was chatting with Damon the other day. We had a loss out here in our football community. Jim Lambright, longtime coach at the University of Washington, forever coordinator, incredible coordinator, was actually my head coach all 4 years of my college career. And there were some different videos playing, and the SID at Washington, a guy named Jeff Bechtold, sent out a YouTube of about 15 minutes of a game in 1990 at Husky Stadium with Todd Marinovich and Mark Brunell quarterbacking. And the Huskies were actually 5-point underdogs. Big national game, beautiful day. I was sitting there as a high school student. I can still remember exactly where I was sitting in the stadium watching it. And it's a game where Marinovich said, "All I saw was purple." That was his comment. That was the headline. And that lived for a long time afterwards. But Damon and I were watching it, and we were talking about this yesterday, and of like, my gosh, how bad were the quarterback fundamentals back in the day? How bad and simplistic was the game? Like, guys are backpedaling and throwing flat-footed, and like, the play action pass was just off of like Fox 2 and in a half roll, and it was so much simpler, and the guys' techniques were so much worse. So you put these guys on, as you said, and you start studying them, it's amazing how much the game has advanced.
Well, it doesn't even, I don't even recognize it. I saw a tape of that was on, I don't know what channel, they were showing old games on NFL Network. We were playing the Cowboys in 1980, and it was hilarious. I mean, it was hilarious. You know, the Cowboys were way ahead of the time. They brought in a third down back. They were in shotgun. We stayed in split backs. Or weak side, we called that, you know, formation two, where the halfback was weak, pullback behind you. And, you know, we went in motion every now and then, but we stayed in that formation basically the whole game. Didn't matter if it was third and 20 or whatever. We stayed under center and did that. And I watch it and I go, man, it was just like, defend for yourself out there. It was really incredible. The backpedaling, that's what, you know, listen, Brock, I'll say this. I loved backpedaling. And probably for my first, gosh, I don't know, for most of my career, I backpedaled a lot, and it was great. And I threw the ball, I think, much better when I backpedaled because it got my body swinging and moving. Man, I could hit, and you go, oh, you have to throw left. Bull crap. You could backpedal full speed and plant that foot and turn and throw it right. I just wish I'd have done it more.
Yeah.
And just watching myself play going, oh, my God. If I knew then what I know now, because I do teach a lot of quarterbacks, a lot. That's all I do during the off season. And I just go, and I say this with complete honesty. At 55 years old, I could throw the ball harder than I ever threw it my whole career. Just because I knew more about it, how to, you know, get my foot in the ground, to really drive off of it, you know, get my all the stuff in the right order. And I was throwing one day, and my youngest son's going, damn, Dad. I mean, you know, he's up there a little. I said, man, I got it today. So it's amazing how the position, the game has changed so much. And
who
back then,
it?
And Brock, if you ever look at old films, and Mike, if you do, is that everybody basically played, ran the same plays, same formations, just about every play of the game. It's amazing we ever scored.
We talk about some of the coaches that changed the style of the game, but what about the quarterbacks? Who were the first guys to start dropping back the way we see them do it now? Who were the guys who broke some of those tendencies, Brock, that you just mentioned?
Well, look, the guy that really, a great innovator, you know, I always talk, there's five or six guys that I think have changed NFL football. I used to keep lists of them, but it's Bill Walsh. Bill Walsh is the first one that I remember. You know, he worked me out twice at Morehead State. And listening to him talk to me, I was like going, what? You know, everybody drop back, throw the ball hard, throw this, how far can you throw it, all these things. And Bill Walsh is sitting there, I'm dropping back and just throwing lasers. I'm ripping at every throw. He goes, whoa, what are you doing? And I just looked at him, he goes, come on, throw it. I want you to be more graceful, be graceful in this, and throw it nice and pretty. Okay. And I'm going, what? So I threw the ball. He goes, no, still way too hard. Drop back more. Be smoother. Throw the ball. I want it to look really nice and make it easy to catch and whatever. And long story short, when the workout was over, I'm going, man, this was awesome. Because I threw for about over an hour for him. And all he would do, he goes, oh, that's so pretty. Oh, that's it. And, you know, it was, of course, it didn't stick with me. But I used to watch films of Joe Montana. I remember in year three going, damn, look at him. They are a machine. And he was the guy that kind of changed how to teach quarterbacks a different way and changed how they did and played. And, of course, it did. Joe Montana was the first recipient of it. And I think he did a pretty good job with it. You know, so it worked out pretty well.
I wonder where Elway fits in that for you, because everything you say is spot on. And my dad somehow had hijacked this tape, or somebody had given my dad a tape. Man, I must have been in elementary school, certainly junior high. And it was Montana and Young and Steve Bono in just a practice, just an hour practice. And the ball never hit the ground, to your point. And as you were sharing that, I was thinking about how many times I watched that tape, and it was artistry. I mean, those guys were so unbelievably accurate. And then here comes...
It was art.
Yeah, it was artwork. And then here comes Elway, who was able to paint some pictures physically with velocity, with athleticism, with extending plays. To me, if Montana and Walsh were maybe the first artists in the system, don't you think in some degree what Elway was able to do with his physical creativity was maybe the next step in that evolution?
Yeah, it had to be up there. There's no doubt. I mean, John Elway was, you know, they talk about, you know, all these things about quarterbacks coming out in the draft. Let's see, John Elway, I don't think he ever had a winning season at Stanford, did he? Or he never went to a bowl game. And his last year, you know, whatever. So with all that great talent, they still couldn't win. So some judge the quarterback, not the team and the players and the system. But John Elway, you're right. The moving, the power of the throwing, the techniques, everything like that. You know, his technique was... He was way ahead of his time. He knew how to get in position where he could really fire the ball. And I don't think I really respected it enough. I think when you play, you know, you just, hey, come on. It's you against the other quarterback a lot of times. That's the way you think. You know, I want to beat him so bad. But when I got out of the plane and started doing games, I'm standing at Denver, standing right there in their huddle because I knew Mike Shanahan. He goes, yes, stand anywhere you want. So, hell, I'm right up there listening to the plays, the calls. I'm standing behind Elway as he drops back, and he's throwing the ball, and I'm going, holy Christ. You know, it was just so impressive to see in person and judge him as an analyst instead of, you know, judging him as a competitor that we're going to play against and things like that. And it was truly really, I came away going, wow, that was great just to watch him do it.
Are there guys from either your era or maybe soon afterwards that didn't get a ton of credit then because they didn't fit the time, but would have fit a lot better in today's era of what we're asking of quarterbacks?
Well, what do you think about, you know, just what would John Elway be if you put him in today's game? I mean, he would be Patrick Mahomes, maybe better. You know, probably he had a stronger arm than Patrick Mahomes as far as just driving the ball. You know, that's what he would be. And, you know, all the freedom, he would change his body, of course, too. You know, he'd be even more limber and all those things that you want to be and stuff like that. And I'll tell you, a guy that was truly a physical phenom or freak, whatever you want to say. Have you ever watched old tapes of Terry Bradshaw? I mean, it wasn't picture perfect how he threw it. But, man, he could stripe the ball. He was big as hell. He could really run. He was rugged as heck. And, you know, if he played in today's game again, you'd go, he would be, again, it would fit him perfectly. He would even be better than he was back when he played with the Steelers. Now, at the end of his career, he became a really good thrower of the ball because he started relying on the pass a little more than just running Rocky Blyer and Franco Harris. But, you know, I look back and see him. And then I'll tell you another guy that was, if he was in, Burt Jones. Did you ever see Burt Jones or watch tapes of him?
Yep.
I mean, oh, my God. I was out on the field in 1980 down in Baltimore in a preseason game, warming up, just messing around. And I'm watching him warming up, and I'm going, wow, this is embarrassing. I'm going down to the other end to warm up because he could. There was a reason why they call him Louisiana rifle, something else.
Yeah.
But whatever. He could really throw the ball and could do anything he wanted with it. Big, really good athlete. And just once again, you know, unlucky because he got hurt.
The Rustin rifle.
In today's game.
The Rustin rifle. He's from Rustin, Louisiana.
The Rustin rifle. There you go. I was going to say the Baton Rouge rifle.
What was the kid's name in Washington a few years, like, I don't know, 20 years ago, came out of Rustin also. He wasn't very good. He went to...
Tim Rattay?
No, it was another guy. No. I'll think of his name. He played for the
Rams. Oh, I know. Not Shuler. Not Heath.
I'll come up with a name. You go ahead.
Yeah, I know who you're thinking about. Well, it is funny.
Is Tim Rattay, was he the quarterback the New England Patriots were trying to decide whether to take Tim Lattay or Tom Brady?
I think it was. Yeah, late in the draft.
I think it was.
How
about that? They're actually sitting around, who should we take? And Dick Rabine, the tight end coach, says, look, I guess he had been down and saw Tom Brady. We need to take Brady. Boom, 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 and there you go. How about that?
Here is a podcast fun random hypothetical. You say you do all these trainings with QBs, and you've been doing that the last number of off seasons and spend a ton of time. I am curious, like, if you could take guys over the last 40 years, a little bit of what we talked about, this window, or maybe, you know, 50 years, if you go back to Bradshaw in his absolute prime, but over the last 40 or 50 years, right? If you were doing this little QB training, and you took guys in their absolute prime, Elway, right out of Stanford, Patrick Mahomes, you know, right now, or you know, a couple years ago, and just the absolute phenoms when it comes to simply throwing the football, it would be fascinating to see who would be at the top of the list, who truly had a fastball unlike anybody else, who truly could move and throw, because Mahomes, and my little son Titus is just, you know, infatuated with him right now. Oh, a little bit. Yeah, Titus is a little too big. He doesn't have the body control right now to do that, but he is absolutely infatuated, as I think a lot of young athletes are, and what he is capable of doing. But I'd be curious how far you'd have to go down that list before you'd put the guy in this town, before you'd put Russell Wilson with his ability to throw it deep, his ability to throw on the run, his ability to, you know, change arm angles and throw. It'd be interesting to see where and how far he would fall on that list of the 10 best or 25 best, just physical phenoms of throwing a football.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was talking about, well, you know, first off, when you all these quarter, we have kids. I do train a few in the pros, you know, quietly. And we got quite a few major college players. My son Matt does it, and I help out quite a bit. And we have a lot of big time high school players that are going to be Division I. And we work probably, I would say, at least 50% of the time on moving, throwing, running to the right and throwing across the field to the left, running to the left sideline, throw across your body to the right, things like that. And I said, your coach is going to hate it when you do it until you complete it, and they're going to say, man, that was a great play. Yeah. So just to get, but you know, where would I put Russell? Is that, you know, Dan Marino was a phenomenal tactician throwing the football right out of the book, almost how you'd want to even teach a guy in today's game. So he would be up there with Elway, but Russell Wilson, as I was talking to this guy the other day, I said he throws the ball differently than almost anybody in the NFL. He throws it like a baseball. He kind of grips it like a baseball.
Yep.
It's a little more over the top than most throwing motions, but you're right. He can dip it anywhere. What is Russell's height? 5'11"?
He's just under 5'11".
5'10", 5'8".
Okay, so whatever. But he has, here's what I always say, too. He might be short, but he's a big man. You know, he's thick. He's got long arms, big hands for a guy his height and everything like that. And, of course, that has been... That actually helps him, his height and everything, because it makes him even more maneuverable and quicker when it comes to making the move to get away from the rush. And, you know, my son, Christopher, he's in love with Russell Wilson. I mean, he thinks he's one of the top three quarterbacks every year. I don't know why people don't talk about Russell more. And he's, you know, he's always saying it. And it's true. He gets lost in the shuffle. One, he's out in Seattle. We don't get to see a lot of their games like we do on national TV at 1 o'clock when, you know, or whatever, and at 4 o'clock. I don't know. We don't, but he's, of course, going to the Hall of Fame. And you're right, Brock. He's not a good thrower of the ball. He's a great thrower of the ball. And he can do it all. He can throw it from any angle, running, right, left. He can throw it with great power. But I think the most impressive thing of all is his touch of throwing the ball up in the air and dropping it down on guys. It's been great. And did I think he was going to be this guy? Of course not. No. But it doesn't look like it's slowing down. In fact, I think he's throwing the ball better now than he ever has. I thought last year when I watched him. The other thing, too, about quarterbacks, what you kind of judge, and Jameis Winston, a lot of great stuff, but he loses control of the ball 3 times a game. Which, you know, 3 times a game, that means 1 or 2 interceptions probably. And Russell never loses control of the ball, which is really impressive.
All right, two things. One, Patrick Ramsey is the guy I was trying to think of, who's also
Oh, Patrick Ramsey,
big,
Tulane.
Big Patrick Ramsey.
Strong arm, throws straight balls, all that. you know, not a just average athlete, whatever. Yes, remember him well.
The guy who played, he's a little after you, but he probably crossed over for a couple of years, who I was thinking as you were talking there about Russell, who would have done well today is Doug Flutie. If Doug Flutie were coming out now and they could have built an offense around him, don't you think he would have been much more successful now than he was then?
He'd be Kyler Murray. He'd be Kyler Murray. Yeah, I do. He would be drafted, maybe drafted high, whatever. You know, Doug Flutie's another one. Look, I know Doug well. He's got big old hands. He's got arms that hang down to his knees. And, you know, he can throw from anywhere. He had a strong arm. And, of course, he was lightning quick, and you know, and he could make all the throws. He's another one. He could have been running left and throw the in cut to the right. So, and even to this day, I saw him about this time last year. We were at a wedding together, and you know, we're talking and this and that up in Boston, and he's, yeah, I'm playing in the baseball league. I do this. I'm not like, Doug, man, you know, it's over. Let it go. But you're right. He was ahead of his time. He really was. And even when he got back into the league, he didn't get a chance. You know, the Bears, that didn't work out because the other quarterbacks hated him. And then he's doing a pretty good job up in Buffalo. Then they go to the playoffs and they start Rob Johnson over Doug Flutie.
Dumb.
So, yeah, pretty tough. It was pretty tough, but he still made it work. I don't know how many championships he won up in Canada. Quite a few, I think, Grey Cups. But in today's game, he would be on the draft board. I'm not going to say he's going to be a first-round draft pick. Kyler Murray was, and Doug Flutie's bigger than Kyler Murray. So maybe he would have gone in the first round.
Phil, thank you. We miss you. We miss talking to you. I miss hearing you. I still miss you on Sunday games. So thank you. It's good to catch up with you. You are
always invited.
Well, it's good
to catch up. I'm surprised. I wish we could have talked about the QBs just a little. I will say this. I like Justin Herbert a lot. I don't get
you
it.
Do.
You know, there's kind of this anti-Justin Herbert thing. I always feel it. I listen to all these guys and read it. He can drive the ball. He's accurate. He throws it. He's big. He can run. I just don't get why it's – hey, was their offense great? No. If you put Justin Herbert down in Alabama in that offense, I'll tell you what, he would have done everything that Tua did and maybe more because he can run and he can make every throw that you need made. And I don't think he's getting the I don't want to say the hype, but the respect that he deserves. He went down the Senior Bowl, Player of the Week, MVP of the game, combine, looked good. You know, when you watch him on tape, you just see, wow, that was a really good throw. Oh, that's another good throw. The offense, yeah, it was, what's the word for it? It was elementary compared to, you know, what you see from some of these bigs. Tua played in a pro offense. And, of course, shoot, I'm losing. Joe Burrow. I know I always get just Joe Burrow. He played, of course, in a pro offense, too, and did a great job with it. And, you know, we keep talking about college football coming to the pros. Well, we saw in Joe Burrow, we saw pro football go to college, and that worked out pretty dang well for Joe Burrow, that's for sure.
You like him?
I'll leave it at that.
You like Burrow?
I like him a lot. I really do. Do I wish he could put just a little more juice on the ball, yes, but really good feet, feels the rush like as good as anybody when they're around him because he played under pressure, played a lot of tough situations in the SEC, extremely accurate. I hate to say it, he knows how to play. He's just got a great feel, reads defenses really well, goes to the right spot, tremendous touch on the football, accurate as can be. And then the other thing too, guys, he is a really good athlete, you know. Yep. His legs won the national championship for him, I thought, against Clemson. So,
well, I'll tell you what. You get that computer fixed, all right? You and John Clayton seem to have similar issues with computers every once in a while. You get that computer fixed, you watch Eason, and you let me know, and maybe we'll catch up before
will.
Or after the draft.
I can't wait to watch him. And here, awesome. As I'm talking to you, I got three computers right in front of me, and so that makes it even worse that I have to go buy another one. And he's, I don't know if you, when's the last time you bought a computer, Brock?
Yeah, been a while. Been a while, Phil.
Well, let me tell you something. The price hasn't come down, okay? I looked at what I got to get all the information downloaded onto my computer because they changed the system, and I just went, oh, my God. So the price hasn't come down in those, so oh, well. But great talking to you guys. Have a good day, and I look forward to talking to you before the draft.
All right. Thanks, Phil. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Phil.
All right. Thank you, guys.
You're the best.
All right, man.
Ooh, what a, this is a powerhouse today, Brock, between 20 minutes of arguing at the beginning. You got a, I don't know, what, 38 minutes or so of the great Phil Sims. God, I love Phil Sims. He just puts a smile on my face. I don't know if I agree with everything he said, but I just enjoy him. And I really do miss him. I know that Tony Romo is going to get paid all the money to be the big CBS guy and this and that. But and I know that I know why people started to object to Phil by the end of it. I just didn't have that problem. I just always liked the way – I just enjoy Phil. I love the folksy way he hangs out with me during a game.
He is a he's a podcaster. He is built
he
for
–
I think I shot you
he's
and
got
Kyle
a lot to
the,
say.
The text he sent me when I asked him if he could jump aboard, and he said, I'm in no hurry. Oh, and I'm glad he is in no hurry because he's got a lot of wisdom through his decades to share.
All right. Well, we didn't do as much Seahawks real content on this particular podcast because I haven't really done a whole lot. I was shocked to see that Tedrick Thompson got released. I mean, I know he's out there seeking a trade, but for whatever reason, I guess it didn't come to fruition. So Tedrick got released and Ed Dixon got released.
Is ProSize signed anywhere?
No, stop it. Come on. You know, don't insult the poor man. Like, that's not nice. He's not going to get signed anywhere. Do you think he's a first wave in free agency guy?
But Effetti got his one-year deal.
Well, yeah, but come on. Effetti played every down. CJ ProSize amazingly hurt his other ankle. I mean, come on. What are we talking about? So, not a ton for the Seahawks to do. I will admit, Brock, I really, really missed opening day over the course of the last week. We didn't get to talk too much about that either. It was such a shame not having opening day. It just, you know, the spring is starting to happen. It's starting to be nice out at least some of the days. We're getting some sunshine. You can get outside a little bit. And to not have baseball along with that, it just doesn't feel right.
Yeah, I think of all the sports, that's the one that's most seasonal. Like most connected seasonally to kind of just flip that switch. Like, okay, spring's here, summer's coming, let's go. And like everything right now, everything's put on hold.
Yeah, just a bummer. All right, hey, this was fun. It was good good not seeing you, but talking to you for an hour or so here. We will do it again next week. Until then, the hey.
Easy in the bar.
See everybody.
Get to the chopper!